I'm Doc Issues from Capes on the Couch, a show that examines the mental health issues of comic book characters, part of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're checking out now. Shows on the network are individually owned, and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other amazing geeky shows at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
This is the official GunnaGeek.com show. Here we run down the latest news and happenings in the world of geek. These are your hosts for the show, Steven, Chris, and SP.
Welcome to an all-new episode of the official Gunna Geek Show. This is episode 410, and I am Steven, and I'm pleased to say Chris Farrell is here.
I'm improvising in jazz just for you guys.
Also, he is here. He's the one that you have written your letters to your favorite member of Congress to say, hey, we like him. He's SP.
Your favorite member of Congress. Well, really, it should only be your representative in Congress, which is two senators here. I don't know how you guys do a legislature up in Canada. Do you have like a parliament or a religious, and do you elect them?
It's mostly just moose fighting. Winner takes all.
Oh, see, we do that with cocks down here, but it's illegal.
Oh, fair enough. Fair enough.
Hey. Roosters, people, please don't think I meant something different.
That changes everything.
Not what we were talking about in the pre-show.
We are here with another episode. And if you didn't know this, we are part of the Gunna Geek Network. The Gunna Geek Network has a bunch of amazing geeky content in it. So you should go check out all of the awesome shows that are over there. There are some of us that stream live. There are some that do not. But it doesn't matter because all of us are hobby podcasters over on the Gunna Geek Network. So you should definitely check that all out. And also, while you're there, you should also tell us what is your internet speeds? Because there's a lot of conversation happening behind the scenes lately about internet speeds and people, more and more people getting fiber. And we want to know, where do you land in that? Because right now we just stream a measly like 7.5 megabits per second out to YouTube. Maybe we should do 85
gigabit.
Yeah.
Let's overwhelm the YouTube ingest server.
I like it. All right, let's kick off the news this week with a story that is all about Sony. For those of you who haven't been following this for a while, Chris Farrell has become our anti-Sony guy. In fact, said that he hates all things Sony. He wishes that he never bought a PlayStation 5, and this is all because he hates Spider-Man.
Caveat, I never bought my PlayStation 5. I want it.
Well, you bought it with your soul, so...
I'm wondering what you did to, you know, bribe the contest there.
Nothing. Though, to be fair, I've bought enough merch from Danhausen since winning that he's probably made back his PlayStation money or close to it.
Well, go ahead, resident Sony hater.
Resident Sony hater. So, you know, I have a Sony surround sound hub. It doesn't matter. I'll wear the hat because that's what Steven's painted me with. But yes, I do have a PlayStation 5. So I've been paying a little bit of attention to Sony's PSVR 2 setup. For those that are unaware, with the PlayStation 4, we had the original PSVR, which was one of the ways to most easily get virtual reality into people's living rooms because it easily paired with the PlayStation 4. And yes, PSVR 1. Can pair with the PS5. These are tongue twisters. I apologize. But the PSVR 2, as I stutter through all of this, seemingly is in a bit of a different state and not as successful as Sony had expected. Bloomberg is reporting Sony has produced over 2 million units of the latest virtual reality headset, but they're hitting pause on production. Why? Because they haven't been able to sell a ton of their inventory. The PSVR 2 is kind of just sitting on shelves. They've seen through their statistics and metrics that shipments have declined each quarter since it was initially released. Bloomberg tends to think that the problem might be a couplefold. First, PSVR 2 is compatible with only a handful of AAA games. This includes Horizon Call of the Mountain and Gran Turismo 7 and some Resident Evil games and a few indie smaller games. But the problem here is the PSVR off the shelf costs $549. Just for comparison, guys, how much in American dollars does a PlayStation 5 with a disc drive retail for?
I don't know.
Too much.
Too much is an accurate answer, but it retails for $499 right now. So a peripheral for the PlayStation 5 and the PSVR 2 costs more than the console. Ooh. That's a tough sell for folks.
How much did the PS5 cost when it first came out, though?
I don't think it's had a price drop yet. We're still at $500 retail. Oh,
COVID pricing, you'd have to get it on the second market at about a grand or something like that.
Yeah, so secondary market prices jumped up, and there were a lot of people that actually bought PSVR 2s as speculators to try and scalp on eBay. And I guess the only good thing about this pause right here is those people that tried to scalp and sell a bunch of PSVR 2s probably got their butts handed to them because they didn't make any money off of it. So, haha, screw you, scalpers. You reap what you sow.
Take that.
So, in part, we have a problem when it comes to games for the PSVR 2. We also have a problem with the most recent crop of Sony's layoffs. So, I don't know if you guys noticed, but one of the studios closed was Sony's London studio. The London studio is the one that was behind most of the more out there games. And by out there, I mean things that use the old iToy camera on the PS3 and PS4, and a lot of the virtual reality games that were developed for PlayStation were developed in the London studio. All of those folks pretty much got laid off and the studio shut down. So Sony loaded up on the PSVR 2, trying to cash in on the craze, because there was a craze there, but didn't get a ton of games out to get people in, a handful that were really good, and then everyone went, where's everything else? There is nothing else right now. There's no major titles coming to PSVR 2, and the studio that would make them has been shuttered right now. So I think they might have a bit of a problem. How they're trying to get around this is Sony had recently announced they're going to begin testing PC support, meaning the ability for PSVR 2 players to access other games on PC. Now, we have no idea what the system requirements are going to be on these PCs or how widespread this support's going to be, but I'm not trying to be negative here, but it seems like Sony may have over-anticipated the draw to PSVR 2. And I don't know. I think VR in general, we're starting to see less and less interest in it. Now we're seeing the Oculus device, or the Meta Quest devices, because they're not called Oculus anymore. But most of those are just kind of gimmicks. There's some interesting games, and Apple's new augmented reality VR thing, it's got some cool productivity stuff, but there's not really anything out there that makes me like, oh my God, I have to have a VR to play this.
Yeah, I think you nailed it, because when you look at things like the popularity of the Meta Quest 2 and the Meta Quest 3, it's things like Beat Saber, because those are drawing a lot of fun. It's like the Wii days when Wii came out and it's like, okay, this is a highly underperforming spec device, but it was a unique way to entertain. I think that's the same thing with the headsets, is they've got to have an appeal factor, something that does make it different, not just, oh, I'm playing my favorite games in VR. I don't think that people get drawn into that. So I think, you know, the rumor is as well, Meta Quest 3, there's a light coming, and my son actually has a Meta Quest 2. And when I was looking at that at Christmas, I was kind of confused myself between the 2 and the 3, you know, what someone would want who was just looking to play games. And the 3 was really targeted. Yes, it has a bit better specs, but it was really targeted for that mixed reality thing. And apparently this Meta Quest 3 Lite is going to get rid of that again. And my guess is it's because the Meta Quest 2 is still popular for people because it's cheaper than the Meta Quest 3, but doing the things they want to do. So they probably want to create a new device that has that same appeal as the Meta Quest 2. And when you have a device here with Sony that costs a heck of a lot more than, well, not a heck of a lot more, but it costs more than the console, but it's a heck of a lot more in the big picture of gaming in your gaming system, I think you have to have that thing that draws you in. And what is that with the VR2? I haven't seen it.
I don't think it exists. And honestly, I'll be the first to admit, I have turned into a casual gamer as I've gotten older because life gets in the way. It's part of growing up. But when I talk about video games with my friends, we're not talking about any of the virtual reality stuff at this point in time. It's, hey, have you played Spider-Man 2? Hey, have you played such and such? It's all just general releases for consoles and PCs and not really getting into any of the VR games. Because here's the thing. Maybe it's just because we're old. Most of my friends who are around my age, give or take 5 to 10 years, we're all just playing standard video games, not the VR stuff. Maybe VR is bigger with a younger crowd that I am not as connected with. I don't know.
So I pulled up a couple of websites here because I was just interested in like what exactly is the demand for this sort of stuff. So academyofanimatedart.com has this webpage of like 10 different stats for the use of VR. And number one is an estimated 64 million Americans used VR in 2022. Number two is 101.6 million people in the U.S. Americans use augmented reality. Not quite sure. I don't believe that, but okay. Number three is almost one third of VR users use virtual reality at least monthly. So those that have it use it on a monthly basis. Number four is the total number of active virtual reality users in 2022 is well over 171 million. Number five is by 2025, the worldwide AR/VR gamer user base will increase to 216 million users. So they're right there is the projected by 2025 is going to go up. I don't necessarily. Okay, here's number 11. Virtual reality headset sales are growing 31.9% year over year. So when Sony made this, they're thinking, they're seeing all this stuff. And I also pulled up a Statistica graph that shows that it's growing, but not gangbusters. From 2020, the video games destined to be niche in VR, it was 42.3 million. And then up to 51.3 million, but the VR, that's total video games, but the VR was only 0.4 million to 1.7 million. I don't know what the basis of that is. So basically, I don't see a huge demand, even in the studies, for this hardware.
I don't think that the future of VR as it is now is video games. I think the future of it is augmented reality, productivity kind of stuff. Now, I'm not going to rush out to pay $3,500 to buy the whatever the Apple Vision or whatever the name of the device is, but it is kind of cool the fact that you can sit at your desk, it'll literally sync up with the display on your MacBook, and then you can create a bunch of different desktops and apps and have them around it in real-time space. There's something interesting about that fact that when you go to your workspace, you put your headset on and boom, you're just inundated with all the information you need, but not $3,500. Interesting. And when you go and read the reviews of that, everyone's like, hey, this is really cool at first. And then at the end, you're like, well, what am I really going to use this for? After I've played around and done all of these things, what's my actual use case for it? And I think that has been the problem we keep having with all the VR and augmented reality stuff is it looks really cool at first. You have fun. And then you go long-term and go, but what am I going to do with it? What is my long-term use of this device? I don't think it's there yet.
Yeah, and I think that came to the forefront when the Apple Vision Pro did come out, because you did have a lot of reviewers who were giving it its fair credit. Apparently, there's not a device on the market that puts out as good of a visual as that. Apparently, it just destroys everything from just a pure visual perspective. However, people were making that point, like, what are the things that people are going to be doing on a day-to-day basis? It's probably not mixed reality, and you can buy yourself a Meta Quest 3 for a lot less and do a lot of those interesting VR games that are out there right now. So I think you nailed it.
I mean, I'll be honest, much like any of those reviewers and stuff out there, I would love to play around with one of these devices for productivity purposes, just to see what it could do for me, because I think it could be kind of neat. But I don't know that long term it's something I'd want to go with, because right. I don't know. I think it feels more exhausting to be like, well, OK, I left my window for my Twitter DMs in the kitchen by accident. I'm sure there's a way to actually recall it, but having to go pick up my windows from around the house because I need something. I mean, maybe it's an oversimplification here. The concept is cool. I just don't really see the need for it yet, I guess is the best way of putting it.
Do you guys remember in 2017 when augmented reality and particle physics combined in science to find a new room in the Great Pyramid?
No, I don't actually.
Yeah.
Did we talk about that?
I think we did, but if we didn't, in 2017, augmented reality and particle physics was used to create or to find a new cavity that had not been explored yet in the Great Pyramid of Giza, I guess. So
which episode did we talk about that?
Well, it was 2017, so I don't know which episode. It was November 2017, so it would probably be one of the ones in the later part of the year if we did talk about it. But this is just me saying that it is useful. It has its uses. I don't know if video gaming is one of the uses that it's going to be really used for. I think it's going to be more used for productivity and at work, where you can, like we often talk about, what kind of monitor are you going to get? You got the 48-inch wide, you got the 4K big, huge, big screen TV monitor, or maybe you don't need any of that. You just go for the mixed reality and you have one of these headsets on and you have a whole cubicle in front of you and that's your entire screen that you're working with, right? I think it's more of a productivity thing than a video gaming thing.
I think you're probably right, but at the same time, for it to become a productivity thing that's widely adopted, okay, if you don't wear glasses, this is real easy, but you're me who needs glasses, then I got to buy special lenses for things, or I got to wear contacts, or I got to find a way to make it work with my glasses on. This just sounds uncomfortable.
See, this is why the headsets are so expensive, because they come with replacement eyeballs.
No, I'm in then. This is like in Minority Report. I get my eye replaced.
Yeah.
I'm in. Let's do it.
I'll be the outlier, and I will say that I think it's reverse. I think that the future is in entertainment, and I think the productivity is the pipe dream at this point.
Yeah, but you see, they're going to jam the productivity down our throat because someone's going to think it's a good idea.
And we know how well the workforce has adapted to changing work environments over the last few years.
They're already starting it in my work just because there's limited facility space. And so, okay, you need a bigger workspace. How do you do it? Well, you can't do it physically, so you do it virtually.
They're just going to start stacking us in cubes is what it comes to. Yeah, instead of being able to stand up in your cube, you'll only be able to squat, so you can have two-story cubicles.
Right. It'll have chairs that stack up on top of each other.
Mm-hmm. This is the way.
Speaking of stacking things, have there been any stackings going on in the space sector?
Well, there's been a destacking last week.
Really? Yeah. Wow.
Now, let's talk about SpaceX's Starship. The last time we spoke, we thought it was going to be imminent for Starship's third test flight, and it would come sometime, and I listened to it today, so I remember this, sometime between the middle of March and the middle of May, because I was counting for Elon time. Well, guess what? There was no Elon time involved. It actually happened in the middle of March, like right when he said it, like first 2 weeks of March, March 14th. That's the first 2 weeks of March. So yeah, SpaceX Starship's integrated flight test 3 was last week. Let's talk about what happened before that, because last time we spoke, there was two failed attempts at a wet dress rehearsal. Now, SpaceX actually completed the repairs on the fueling mechanisms that they had, and they completed a wet dress rehearsal on March the 3rd. The flight termination systems were installed in the next week, and the FAA granted a launch license on March 13th, 2024. Due to the launch pad changes, SpaceX was able to reduce its propellant loading time from 97 minutes on Starship Flights 1 and 2 to 50 minutes on Starship Flight 3. By the way, that's 10 million pounds of methane and liquid oxygen propellant being jammed into this thing in 50 minutes.
There's a joke somewhere here. I just don't know what it is. I know there's one there. I'm just not funny enough to come up with it.
Just shout it out when it comes to you, Chris, okay?
It's not going to. That's the problem.
In comparison, Falcon 9 runs on liquid oxygen and a rocket-grade kerosene, and it is full of 345,000 pounds, not 10 million pounds. So there's a difference there. Falcon Heavy so you take that and you multiply it by three and you get 1.1 million pounds. So it's 1/10 of the rocket fuel that is on board Starship. And they're able to do it in less time than Falcon 9. It's just amazing. You know, the big old pipes just shoving all that through there. All right. The launch happened on March 14th, 2024. Let me set the stage. It's a foggy, quiet, overcast morning in Boca Chica, Texas. It's 8:25 a.m. Central Time. And all of a sudden, everything comes to life with the roaring performance of 33 Raptor engines. Yes, they launched it on the morning of March 14th, about an hour and 25 minutes into their two-hour launch window. There was a couple reasons why it slipped. There was a boat in the non-exclusion zone, so that automatically pushed them back. But I think they wanted to go when it was light. And the window, the launch window, was oriented so it was daylight on both the launch site and the recovery site. So while it might have launched if it was at 7 a.m. during darkness, they would have been able to image it once it ran up to altitude and it would have been in the light. So they would have still gotten the images up there. But since it was foggy and there was a boat in the exclusion zone, they pushed it back to 8:25 a.m. The flight, I'm just going to give you the bottom line up front, surpassed the performance of tests 1 and 2, achieved several key goals, and unfortunately fell short of a few key flight objectives that they stated before the flight, and unfortunately triggered another mishap investigation that SpaceX will perform and the FAA will oversee. Now, the flight occurred on Pi Day, which was March 14th, 2024, which also happened to be SpaceX's 22nd birthday.
Wow.
I do like pie.
Yes. What kind of pie did you have on Pi Day?
I didn't have any. I kind of wanted a pizza pie, though.
Mm.
Yeah. I drove up to Minnesota, and my dad had bought this great pizza pie. It was good. I will tell you that. It was good. So I did have
I don't believe in pie, so I don't have it.
Do you believe in math?
No, I don't.
Okay, obviously. Okay. The 33 Raptor engines on Booster 10 lit and functioned through the MECO, which is not main engine cutoff. It's most engine cutoff. And it was the hot staging event at T plus 2 minutes and 41 seconds during the flight. Booster 10 successfully performed the post-staging burn after separation. And that is known as a boost back burn, by the way. And it was enabling a flip maneuver to guide the Starship first stage back towards a planned soft landing over the Gulf of Mexico. And that surpassed the performance of Flight Test 2. Do you guys remember Flight Test 2?
Kaboom.
Yeah, that was the one that almost hit my house, right?
They all almost hit your house.
Oh, we're trying to get closer.
Aiming for your house, yeah. So at T plus 3 minutes 39 seconds, the Booster 10 engines started their shutdown sequence as SpaceX continued to provide incredible views of the booster's return and the flight corrections using their articulated grid fins. This was all in 4K. It was phenomenal. This started at 71 kilometers altitude. At T plus 6 minutes 45 seconds, Booster 10 attempted to relight 13 of its engines to attempt to slow its descent for a soft landing on the Gulf of Mexico from a speed of, and I assume this is terminal speed at the time, 1,330 kilometers per hour. And it's the engines tried to relight at 1 kilometer over the Gulf of Mexico. Booster 10 was unable to relight the engines, and at most had 3 engines lit, and it was for a brief under a second time where they had each engine firing and all 3 engines, which were just all over the rocket, really, they were able to go up, and it was like a frame or two, so not even a second that they had it going on. At T plus 6 minutes 59 seconds, Booster 10 ended its transmission, and it had a final speed of 1,112 kilometers per hour. There was disturbed water in view below, and according to the SpaceX website, It indicated that the flight ended at 462 meters above the surface, which to me says flight termination system activation, because it just didn't fall apart half a click up. It must have exploded because they were like, there's no way we're going to slow this thing down. It must have violated some flight rules and just blew itself up. I have not yet seen any video of this. I assume they have video somehow through a plane or a ship far away or something like that, but haven't seen that yet. So that would be fun to see. Now, rewind. We got to go back to the hot staging event. Ship 28 successfully lit all six of its Raptor engines starting at T plus 2 minutes and 48 seconds, completed the hot staging event, and then continued its nominal burn, placed in a suborbital trajectory at an altitude that started at 210 kilometers and went as high as 234 kilometers, with engines shut down starting at T plus 8 minutes 20 seconds into the flight. That surpassed Ship 25's performance in Flight 2, where they vented the oxygen payload and that caused a fire in the engine bay, which caused the activation of the flight termination system just prior to engine shutdown. So at 8 minutes 20 seconds with engine shutdown complete, the craft entered the suborbital coast phase. Now, Ship 28 was going to always attempt to perform several objectives while it was in its coast phase, including a NASA-led $53 million contract called Tipping Point, which was an intership cryogenic fuel transfer between tanks. It was a demonstration. It's needed in order to make the whole Artemis program work, and that's why the contract was there. NASA said that the, and both NASA and SpaceX said that the demonstration was complete, but data needs to be reviewed. Apparently, there was some concern of fuel sloshing around and that leading to an instability of the spacecraft. So we'll see what the review is on all that. And that might come as a factor for later as well. Also, they were supposed to open and close the payload bay doors, which is called the PEZ dispenser door, by the way, because it looks like a PEZ dispenser and acts like a PEZ dispenser. And they were also going to reignite.
Pie and PEZ. Thank you, SP.
I know.
You're making me hungry.
Well, I mean, if you haven't eaten before this, you know you need to eat afterwards.
I did eat dinner, thankfully.
Okay. Suggestion, what about a PEZ-flavored pie?
That's just sugar.
That's just sugar, yeah.
But PEZ has a unique flavor to it.
It's yeah, that's sugar. All the chemicals.
Yeah. So we could make a chemical pie.
They're all
chemicals.
This
is how we become supervillains.
It's our origin story. Okay. The fuel transfer was performed, but the engine reignition test was abandoned due to vehicle roll rates within the coast phase. The vehicle's payload bay doors was open, but it remains to be seen how successful that test was. All these tests, the data needs to be reviewed for it. And also, I don't know if you guys watched the live feed or not. I know Steven
did.
Chris, did you?
No, I did not.
There was some epic elevator music jazz playing on the X broadcast during the Ship 28 coast phase. It starts at T plus 12 minutes, 29 seconds, and lasted until T plus 38 minutes, 2 seconds. Why do I know this? It's because I watched the video and I marked the times.
Have you extracted the audio to make a ringtone yet?
I mean, that's a long ringtone, but all right.
Is it by chance royalty free? Could we use it?
It reminded me of the Mass Effect, the lift music that's played when you're playing Mass Effect and you're going up and down the Normandy lift.
I mean, they broadcast it on YouTube, so my guess.
No, it's only on X broadcast.
Oh, yeah. They don't care about property rights or anything there. Never mind.
That's right. So after the coast phase, Ship 28 attempted to re-enter the atmosphere and used its fins to provide attitude control with views on board the aircraft or spacecraft starting at T plus 42 minutes and 55 seconds. I'll have to say SpaceX Starlink data transfer ability far surpassed any re-entry live video available to date. No space shuttle video, nothing compares to what we saw. It was amazing. More on that later. So during that same time, material was noticed to be coming off the vehicle during atmospheric maneuvers. It's unknown exactly what the material was. Everybody went immediately to heat shield tiles because there's 18,000 of them and they have been noted to come off, but they didn't look like they were in the form of heat shields because they're hexagonal in shape and they didn't look hexagonal whatsoever. It could have been ice that was being forced off because of the pressures in the upper atmosphere actually going by the spacecraft, or it could have been the payload bay door insulation, if there is any. I haven't seen the design enough to know if that was a thing. It's also unknown whether the payload bay door actually closed, and that has been a speculation. Speculation only. I have no proof either way. It's been rapidly talked about online. Plasma heating was noticed in the video at T plus 46 minutes and 15 seconds, and it started at 97 kilometers altitude until loss of video signal at T plus 48 minutes and 39 seconds at 76 kilometers altitude. And just to let you know, that's more than 2,500 degrees. It's hot. Now, both Starlink and TDRS, which is the Tracking and Data Relay Satellite System, which is owned by NASA, was both used for signal relay, and both of them were lost at 49 minutes, 39 seconds. There was a brief, maybe a second or second and a half reacquisition of signal at 50 minutes and 20 seconds. And at the time of the loss of signal in 49 minutes, the speed was noted at 25,724 kilometers per hour. And there was a 65 kilometer altitude. And that is postulated to be where the system had end of life. No idea exactly what happened to it. They will look at the data and determine what was the likely cause of any breakup. So that transitions nicely into the mishap investigation and the possibility of a future test flight 4. Since neither the Starship vehicle itself, the booster, or the ship was able to attain its planned ocean ending, the FAA initiated a mishap investigation process. SpaceX will perform the investigation and the FAA will oversee the investigation. SpaceX will likely not launch again until the results of the investigation are reported, corrections have been made, and a new launch license is granted by the FAA. To give you an idea of how long this is going to take, the previous investigations, the mishap investigation after flight test 1 found 63 corrective actions. After the second flight mishap, 17 items required fixes. So it's been significantly going down. The time period between flights was roughly 7 months between the first test flight and the second. And then the gap between flight 2 and last week's launch was 117 days, so roughly 4 months. So we're thinking that because we, as a collective community, by the way, everybody that's been interested in Starship, that's the we here, thinking that because the vehicle actually performed better even than flight test 2, that you're just talking about the soft landing ability of Booster 10 and getting through the atmospheric reentry for the Starship, although there might be other things that contribute to that along the way. So everybody's postulating might be under 117 days. I'm thinking it should be around 117 days. So that puts us in the August, mid-August timeframe. So if you're projecting out, I want to see flight test 4, how long is that going to be? Anytime probably between June and August, depending on what actually happened. They might actually have to do a rampant redesign of hardware that they have. Talking about hardware, although not officially announced, SpaceX does have Booster 11 and Ship 29 ongoing testing right now in Boca Chica.
Do the dance.
Yep. Starship Flight Test 1 consisted of Starship 24 and Booster 7. Flight 2 consisted of Booster 9 and Starship 25. So you can see the progression there. As far as Starship's future, Starship is on the NASA Artemis program critical path, and that is including the landing on the moon in September 2026, because the human landing system is basically going to be a Starship. Both Elon Musk, who's the owner of SpaceX, and SpaceX itself have voiced a goal of several Starship launches in 2024, followed by perhaps even daily launches of multiple Starships in the future. That's well beyond 2024. SpaceX currently has 4 boosters and 4 Starships built, with more on the way every day. According to the environmental assessment to grant the Starship launch license, they have asked for up to 10 nominal operations out of Boca Chica, which include, I believe, 5 recoveries of the main vehicle. So that is what their goal is. And then SpaceX has a near-term goal of soft water landing by the end of 2024, and the ultimate goal of landing the Starship vehicle on their towers, or maybe even a barge. I don't know how they're going to do that without a tower, because it doesn't have any landing legs. And then NASA put out a statement, by the way. This is their official statement on the NASA.gov website. Quote, "With each flight test, SpaceX attempts increasingly ambitious objectives for Starship to learn as much as possible for future mission systems development. The ability to test key systems and processes in flight scenarios like these and integrated tests allow both NASA and SpaceX to gather crucial data needed for the continued development of Starship HLS," unquote. Starship is the biggest rocket ever built. And then basically since March 14th, 2022, SpaceX has launched 319 rockets, recovered 283 stages, deployed 6,000 Starlink satellites, and delivered 49 people to and from Earth orbit. So they've got stuff going on. And during the live stream, by the way, the commentator said on a flight test like this with Flight Test 3, the payload is the data. That is the purpose of the flight. So, Stephen, I know you watched it. Chris, I know you're interested in it. What do you guys think of this flight test?
Well, I have to say, you know, with all these failures before this happened, and the fact that this was overall a success, you know, they could have got down, but instead they were just real troopers. You might call them Starship troopers.
I see what you did.
I like
there.
The movie. I like the movie. Chris,
what
do you think?
Far better.
This was so much fun to watch. I lucked out. You were bugging me the day before saying, hey, get up at like 5 o'clock your time. That's when you want to get up. And I didn't set an alarm, but I happened to wake up at about 5 o'clock. And I looked at it and I'm like, I could get up right now. So I rolled over and fell back asleep. And then I woke up and the delays ended up meaning I got to watch it. I literally logged into my computer, turned it on, and I think it was like T-2 or something. It was a phenomenal timing, and I enjoyed watching it.
Yeah, I was slammed that day. My plan originally had been to toss it up on a monitor down here in my home office, but we were busy with so much other stuff that eventually it was the afternoon, and I logged on, and I went, oh, wait, we're done already. Crap.
Did you see the views of reentry, though?
Yeah.
I saw some on social media after the fact, yes.
Yeah, that was crazy. It looked like it was straight up CGI, but it wasn't. It was real.
Or was it AI?
Anywho, absolutely was amazing. I 100% agree with you. I was blown away with how long we could see. And I don't, you know, I do not follow this anywhere as close as you do, SP. I will admit that. There are many times you have said, Steven, watch this, and I have not watched it. But this one, I even watching it with that little experience, I knew that was not a normal thing for us to be seeing. And it was amazing.
It's historical. Definitely. And I had hoped by today that more information would have come out from the flight. And unfortunately, all I was able to do is consolidate all the highlights from the flight. And I'm sorry it took so long, but it was an amazing flight. I don't think we'll have to go through all of this in the future, but in the future, I would bet on the booster being able to at least slow itself down, maybe not completely. How many times did a Falcon 9 crash on a barge, right, before they actually landed one? Yeah. How many times did the ship crash on land as it was coming in before they finally started sticking landings, right? So it's going to take a couple more tries before they're able to get something right. They have 4 systems already built. They have 4 tries in their back pocket. It's just a matter of going through the data, seeing if they need to change anything. And obviously they do, because, you know, they didn't make it, but, but see what needs to be changed and then try that. And it's just amazing what they're able to do, given the fact that this is supposed to be a fully reusable system.
All right, let's go to my less interesting news point. I wanted to talk briefly about this latest rumor coming out of the foldable world. There's a rumor that just came out about a Galaxy Z Fold 6 Ultra, which you might be saying, what? They're making an Ultra version of the Galaxy Z Fold? Yeah. And I'm saying Z just for you guys, just so you're aware.
Yeah, I was like, whoa, where's the Z, man?
Can I say I hate their naming convention?
Yeah, it's so ridiculous.
How am I supposed to know what this is?
Don't worry. I'm going to get even more complicated here, because the Galaxy Z Fold 6 Ultra was actually a rumor. That was a rumor that's been going around for a while, that they'd be creating this summer at the Samsung event. They would be, I think they call it the Unpacked event. They would be announcing this Ultra version of the Galaxy Z Fold. Well, guess what? Apparently, that's actually not going to happen anymore. They are anticipating that instead, that's being scrapped to go the other way and create an FE. So I guess a Galaxy Z Fold 6 FE, which, for those of you not familiar with the Samsung naming convention, the FE is the fan edition, is what I believe it stands for. And that's basically the more budget line of the Galaxy devices, actually Samsung devices in general. That's what they generally put the FE line devices.
It's probably not a bad idea, because you think in terms of how much these devices are going to cost. If you can get them out there at a lesser price, you're probably going to be better off, because nobody wants to buy a $2,500, a $3,000 foldable.
The concept is not my problem. The naming convention is my problem here. Find a clearer way to communicate it than Galaxy Z Fold 6 blah blah FE edition. Oh, come on. Like,
I was recently looking at a possibility of getting a Samsung tablet, and it's like they call it it's very similar naming convention to the phone. Yeah. I forget what it is, but I looked at that. And I'm like, wow, that looks like a Galaxy phone of 10 years ago.
The naming, just where's the brand managers? They're like, hey, we need to clean up this naming so that people understand what the hell it is they're trying to buy. On ATGN, Willie is always having problems with, I can never keep track of what the Xbox naming convention is. If he thinks that's bad, can you imagine Willie when they're like, do you want to buy the Galaxy Z Fold 6 Ultra or the Galaxy Z Fold 6 FE? He's going to, like, if he had hair, he's going to rip it out of the top of his head and be like, I hate this naming.
And on the tablet note, it was a Samsung Galaxy Tab S9 I was looking at. It's like, S9 was the phone. And then they have like the S9 Plus, I think. And then they have like the A9 or A23 or something random like that. Like, they're just bizarre names that they have. Well, I agree with you.
They would call it a note, but yeah.
But the reason I actually bring up this point here, because it is all rumor right now, but I wanted to bring it up because I think there probably is a real world possibility of that, because they have done this FE line. It's quite popular, actually.
Successfully.
Yeah. A lot of times what they do is they take the Snapdragon processor out and they replace it with I never know how to say it. It's Exynos or something like that. It's a more budget processor that doesn't hold up, but a lot of times that's what they do in it. And, I was thinking about the point that SP brought up, which is there a room for this in the foldable line? And I actually agree with what you think, SP, as is probably a good reason to bring the budget idea to the foldable market.
Yeah, even Apple with its phones, right? The Pro model, they're making another like Ultra or Ultimate or whatever above it, because they know that there are really hardcore users out there that really need the, you know, state of the art, everything, but it's just too expensive. So they have to back off like a mid bridge basically and say, well, we're only going to give you this. And I don't know if it's coming out with a 16 or when it's going to happen. It was rumored to come out with a 15. It didn't happen. So yeah, I can see this across the board where affordability is becoming an issue because they're not selling as many units. And we've talked about it before. The units are lasting longer. People don't have enough money. It's actually more expensive. Like I remember when the iPhones were like $300-$400 and now it's $2,000, right? So it's gotten to the point where it's excessively expensive. So let's bring that down a little bit. Let's bring it down to what the average person needs. The average person doesn't need to hack into Star City stuff like Felicity did over on the Arrow show. So they just need to, you know, use it as a reader or as a browser or email machine or something like that, or a social media machine. That's all the average user needs to do it. And if you're an artist or a creator, yeah, you need to do some of that. But do you really need like the most advanced quantum processor on there? I don't think so.
I mean, here's where we are now is that as long as your phone's battery is good, you probably don't need to upgrade every year, every other year like we had been before, because there's not really any major innovations or changes other than software at this point in time. Foldables is the big way to try and attract people into upgrading sooner. But even then, there's no reason really to go from the Z Fold 1 to the Z Fold 2, maybe to the 3 or something like that, if we follow what those patterns were. It's just the simple matter of fact is, we're past that point where it's like, oh my God, there's something new and crazy that I need. Like the only reason I upgraded to my Pixel 8 Pro was because Google gave me a $400 off thing as long as I stayed on Google Fi for 6 months after I did it. And I was like, I'm already on Google Fi. So I took my $400 credit and got a half price Pixel 8 Pro. Otherwise, I'd have stuck with my 6 because it was running just fine and still had, what, another year or two worth of Android OS updates on it?
I have the S23 Ultra, and the reason I actually worked my way up to the Ultra because I wanted the camera, basically, is what it came down to. Fair. And that was the only thing that made me go up that high. Had it been had the pricing been right and it had been a year before, or it had had, you know, the same camera but with a degraded processor or something like that, I would have gone that way because I don't care about all that. Need cutting edge speed. I don't even use the S Pen. As much as everybody said that I would love the S Pen, I very rarely find an actual use for using it for my personal day to day. But it was the camera that brought me in. I was thinking about the whole budget phone things because right now Google has a whole bunch of deals on, including on the 7A, the Pixel 7A, and it's like, if I was somebody that wanted just regular, you know, baseline phone features, you know, just the equivalent on the Apple side of things as just the normal iPhone line, nothing higher, nothing lower, that would be a really appealing thing and would still probably last people a very long time.
Steven, for our two listeners, remind everybody what phone that you upgraded from to go to the 23 Ultra.
I went from the Pixel 6. And the reason I did that was because I made that clear on here. I was annoyed with some of the software things that I felt were Google related. And then the fingerprint reader, the Pixel 6 fingerprint reader, very frustrating.
So, Steven, let me ask you this. Yes. If you were, and I don't think, I'm not going to get into your decision-making process here, but if you were to buy your boys a phone today, mm-hmm. Do you have an idea of where you would want to go with that, considering they're going to be very hard on it and that, well, you only have so much money as a family?
If it wasn't a hand-me-down, it would most likely be a Pixel. It would be a Pixel, probably something along the A line. And okay. I think it would get them by just fine. And they don't both have phones, but they both use Pixel phones already. So they're familiar with Android. And so it wouldn't be too hard to do that. And the other aspect of it is what you said. They could be hard on it. I would much rather them break a cheaper phone than more expensive phone.
No, right. Exactly. That's 100% right.
Well, if you are somebody who's interested in foldables, we would love to hear from you. Come to gunnageek.com/discord because we want to hear your thoughts about foldables. Now, we have a special segment for you right now. We're debuting the Pooniverse update. Go ahead, Chris.
So this news story is only in here because I read it and legitimately had a laugh out loud moment. So if you guys don't realize, Winnie the Pooh by A.A. Milne has entered the public domain. Please note, this is not the Winnie the Pooh we see depicted in Disney wearing the red shirt. This is the nude Winnie the Pooh that has entered the public domain. And as such, when things enter the public domain, they become open for people to make their own adaptations and crazy takeoffs of them. And I don't know if you remember, but do you remember the horror movie adaptation of Winnie the Pooh entitled Blood and Honey that came out?
I remember talking about it when we were talking about public domain.
Yeah, I remember talking about that point in time, too. Well, evidently, they're working on a sequel, which number two is the next part that made me laugh. But number three, they plan to unveil or to use that as the opening act to create the Pooniverse. Monsters Assemble, a slasher horror pick set to shoot this year ahead of a 2025 release. Quote, it will be absolute carnage. We are heavily influenced by Freddy versus Jason and the Avengers. We would love to see a horror movie where the villains group together and are going after their survivors. We have some incredible set pieces in mind and some sequences I think will truly shock people. This was stated by Jagged Edge producer Reese Frake Waterfield in a statement. Yes, so we're getting an assembly of a bunch of crazy monsters from public domain and things like that. For those that aren't aware, Blood and Honey featured a 6-foot-tall Pooh, his sidekick Piglet, and they went on a murderous rampage throughout the 100-acre wood because they were left to fend for themselves by Christopher Robin and went feral. So we'll have the sequel, and now Pooniverse Monsters Assemble, potentially featuring characters like Pooh, Tigger, Rabbit, Owl, Piglet, Pinocchio, Sleeping Beauty, Bambi, the Mad Hatter, Peter Pan, and Tinkerbell, all joining forces together
Tinkerbell.
To wreak havoc. So, yes, when things enter the public domain, we get crazy horror adaptations. I am not really a horror movie person, but the whole concept of the Pooniverse made me laugh, mostly because of the idea, like 90% that and 10% the name Pooniverse, I'll be honest.
I'm all for it. This is awesome. This is great. This is going to make Disney and all of its IPs, including Marvel, really step up its game for the future, you know, Halloween seasons. Because like last year, we had that Marvel Halloween thing. And so I'm looking forward to what they come up with, because this is going to be a big draw. This is going to be a big thing. I predict this is going to be bigger than Sharknado.
Oh my. Mm-hmm. I mean, from a whole B movie spectacle kind of thing, I could see this being one of those things that goes kind of viral, that people make jokes about, have fun with, and watch in group settings and stuff like that. Let's not delude ourselves into thinking this is going to be some cinematic masterpiece that takes things over. They're purposely going for like the B movie horror vibe, it sounds like here, where this is just going to be fun, stupid, and ridiculous. And I mean stupid in a complimentary way, because that's the way these kind of things have to work. Mm-hmm. It just has to be really out there and crazy. That's what I mean.
I hope that somehow in this Bambi gets revenge, because poor Bambi in the Disney movie. It's time for Bambi to get its revenge.
I mean, we saw the SNL sketch where The Rock was Bambi, right?
I mean, oh, I forgot about that.
Disney killed Bambi's mom. I'd be pissed.
Everybody's mom is killed in the Disney movie.
Not that's everybody. His origin story.
There's a couple. I mean, you have
you try to think about it. Keep going.
Hawkeye's family, the mom is still there, right? And I'm MCU thinking Marvel wise, here.
But in the comics, his family life's pretty effed up.
Well, I mean, it's pretty effed up. Yeah. Yeah. That's true. And then Miss Marvel, her mom is still around.
They
just killed her in the comics and turned her into a mutant.
I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah. Miss Marvel in the comics, Miss Marvel is now a mutant, guys, just so you know.
Well, yeah. Yes, that's actually on screen, too.
The on screen changed what she is, because she was an Inhuman that was created from what was the gas cloud that was released. And that gas cloud would kill. Yeah. The Terrigen mist clouds or whatever that killed mutants. That's how they killed Cyclops at one point in time, was exposing him to the Terrigen clouds. So it's very strange that now all of a sudden Ms. Marvel's a mutant. But hey, it works for brand synergy.
Anything to get away from the Inhumans series, I'm all for it.
I was talking about the comics, though.
I know.
I've repressed the TV show. It does not exist in my mind anymore.
I've never finished it. I never ended up finishing
it.
I never started it.
The first episode starts okay. The second one, if you go beyond the second episode, it's on you.
Okay. You made poor life decisions.
I'll make you a deal right here, right now. You can replay this. If you do a rewatch on Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D., I will watch it and join you to discuss.
Steven, he wants to get more subscribers, not lose subscribers.
Yeah, because I see the amounts of people that watch, like, I had the whole Echo series and then went to Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur. I've got the download numbers from that jump. It's not pretty.
Good thing we got the X-Men coming up.
I know. Well, that's got controversy with it too now.
Everything has controversy now.
Well, thank you everybody for joining us. We hope you enjoyed our debut Pooniverse segment. I hear it's going to be coming back regularly. So
yeah, I'm looking forward to the next update next month.
Niverse.
Yeah. If you like to hear all sorts of geeky content, please go to gunnageek.com and check out Chris Farrell on the All Things Good and Nerdy podcast, which I think, you know, after our Pooniverse segment, I think that you are the highbrow between the two podcasts. And then also, check out SP over on Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yep, I'm looking forward to X-Men 97, which is a continuation of X-Men, the animated series, or X-Men 92. That will be this Saturday. Chris, you joining us?
Actually, my wife is going to be out of town from 7 a.m. till like midnight. So if you need more people, let me know and I'm happy to hop on.
Anybody that wants to talk about, I think it's going to be a 2-episode premiere. So we're looking forward to seeing it. What, 3?
I thought it was going to be dropping the first 3 and then going weekly.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Well, that there's only 9 episodes, right?
10, I thought.
All right. Well, it just shortened their run then.
So that's going to go ahead and take us to another end of another episode of the Official Gunna Geek Show. I'm Steven saying Albert nailed it. Make sure that you got fiber to watch the Pooniverse.
I'm Chris, and I'm going to flush this show now.
MSP. We'll be seeing everybody next month. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for checking out another episode of the official GunnaGeek.com show. If you like the show, please give us a 5-star review in Apple Podcasts or a thumbs up on YouTube. You can always join us for our live recording sessions at www.geeks.live. And remember, you can find our full back catalog at gunnageek.com/show. If you're itching for more geeky content, check out other shows on gunnageeknetwork.com. Voice work was by Emily Prokop of the Story Behind podcast. That's it for this episode. We hope to see you back again next show.